Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the April 22nd broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Italian Tomatoes. I'm your host, Bob Curie. It is Wednesday, April 22nd, and tonight we're going to talk about the upcoming presidential campaign and specifically the likely candidacy of Jeb Bush. And, of course, the title of the show is Why Jeb Bush is Not the One. And I chose that as a topic because, as the title suggests, I think there are huge obstacles in the way of him running a successful campaign for the presidency, and we're going to go into those today. The chat is open if you wish to participate in the chat, and if you wish to call into the show, the number is 646-478-0004. That's 646-478-0004. Don't know what kind of live listenership we'll have tonight. The weather in the Dallas-Fort Worth area is quite stormy, and I'm hoping that I don't have to interrupt the show for a thunderstorm. So far, the weather map looks pretty promising, but the forecast is for scattered severe thunderstorms with possibly very damaging winds, large hail, and even the isolated possibility of tornado. So if we have a weather event, obviously the show was going to be cut short. The candidacy of Jeb Bush, very interesting stuff at play here. And so I'm going to just briefly summarize the outline of the show and then go into my points in more detail. Political dynasties have advantages. They provide tradition, stability, continuity, and a ready source of personnel and expertise. But dynasties must move with the times. And that's where I have a lot of reservations about the Bushes. They have a very long and commendable tradition of public service, very admirable qualities in many respects. One of the most admirable, considering what's going on the Democratic side with Hillary Clinton, is that there is a strong tradition in the Bush family that if one of their family members goes into politics, he must first make a success out of himself in business and, you know, provide a living for himself and his family before he goes to sell his skills as a politician. And so financial corruption is something that is very low risk when you deal with the Bushes, which is unfortunately not what you could say about some of the Democratic politicians. I'm a big fan of Barbara Bush, who, you know, is just kind of an amazing figure in her own right. She married one president, had a son who became president, and, you know, just the idea of a second son becoming president really confirms the power of her role as a family matriarch. But it was interesting for me when the idea of a Jeb Bush candidacy came up, she was very cool to the idea, and she said, you know, basically, there's, you know, you can have too much of one family on the political scene, and it was not the time for another Bush to make the run for the presidency. And, you know, my, what kind of that, and then she eventually changed her mind. And to me, the old adage comes into my head where, what are you always told when you're taking a test? Don't second guess yourself. Your first instinct when you respond to a question is usually the right one. And I think her instinct here was the right one. And for reasons of family loyalty, she changed her mind. But I think her instinct there was correct. And Barbara Bush had very sound instincts, has very sound instincts. Just a few more words on that subject. One of the things I remember very fondly about her back in the day when her husband was running against Bill Clinton, she was very forthright in saying that, you know, look, the wife of the president has no elected role, and I think she was telegraphing a very different approach to her role as first lady and contrasting that to what Hillary wanted to be, which was essentially a co-president and power player. And then another fond memory I have of her when she was recounting her life in the White House, she was talking about the myth that the Bushes were living at public living large at public expense, and she pointed out that a lot of the entertaining that they did was at their own expense. And the figure that she quoted was when they served breakfast, she knew that it cost 18 cents an egg to serve breakfast to guests. And to me, that was the signal of a very rooted, pragmatic, shrewd lady who realized that the office was a public trust and it wasn't something to be abused and to live high on an expense account. And that, again, is a welcome contrast to subsequent occupants of that office. Well, anyway, why am I not a fan of the Bush candidacy? And I want to keep this objective and not, you know, rant and rave and talk about things in terms of buzzwords and attack words like Jeb Bush is a rhino, he's not a real Republican, he's this, he's that. I think there are real objective things that you can point to that indicate that he probably isn't the guy that is going to wage a successful campaign for us. So the themes I'm going to go into are, I'm going to list them first. One is winning elections. The second is building coalitions. The third is the quality of advisors and management skills being brought to the office of president. Third, another one is skill at handling identity politics. Another one is foreign policy. And sort of a wrap-up comprehensive category is the Bush brand. So those are the things I want to go into and explain why I have so many reservations about a Jeb Bush candidacy. But first, I want to check chat and see if anybody needs attention. Doesn't look like anybody does. So let me just take care of one thing here and take a look at the weather map. Very interesting stuff living in Texas in April. You really pay attention to the weather forecasts at this time of year because you never know if at the end of one of these stormy evenings if you'll still have a roof over your head. But so far it looks like the only storms are well north of here on the Red River and well south of here in the Waco-Palestine areas, and there are no weather alerts. So that is all good. Okay. The first thing about elections is you have to win them. And the Bushes actually have a very spotty record when it comes to winning elections. And this goes back quite a long way in the family history. George H.W. Bush failed to win statewide office in Texas. The only thing he was able to do was a congressman. And then after that, his career was in basically appointed offices, ambassador to China, head of the CIA. And then he ran for president in 1980 against Ronald Reagan and lost, obviously. So his electoral skills were somewhat debatable. Now, in 1988, he ran successfully for president as the heir of Reagan, and as we all know, he departed very significantly from Reagan policies when he endorsed a very activist regulatory agenda as president and, of course, raised taxes. And in 1992, in the middle of a recession and general resentment that he broke his pledge on taxes, he lost. George W. Bush was successful in winning statewide office and was, in fact, a rock star for Republicans in terms of Texas state politics. He ran against Ann Richards in 1994, and nobody thought he could win, and he did win. And then, of course, he won a landslide when he ran for re-election as governor. But in 1998, but in 2000, his presidential campaign, even though there was so much that you could criticize about Al Gore and the Clinton legacy, especially the corruption of Clinton and the kind of weirdness of Al Gore, George W. Bush was not a very good campaigner and did not have very good campaign strategists. And he wound up losing the popular vote and winning the narrowest of margins in the Electoral College after a protracted fight over Florida. And the electoral tally was 271 for Bush for 267 for Gore, which is as narrow as an electoral victory as you could get. In 2004... he did win election, but again, very narrowly. He got roughly 51% of the vote. It was a very close election. He got a few more electoral votes than he did on the first run, but again, very close election. Outcome was in doubt until very late in the campaign. So that's a very checkered tradition as far as winning elections is concerned, and Jeb is not any better. He lost his first run for statewide office in 1994. He won in 1998, and he won re-election in 2002. But 2002, by the time 2016 rolls along, is 14 years in the past. So what we are being asked to do is to put our confidence in a guy who has not been tested in the electoral arena for 14 years. And we're being asked to rely on his political skill in pulling off a victory. And as we will explore further down in this broadcast, that political skill is very much a debatable thing. So I think Jeb Bush is rusty. He hasn't faced an electorate in quite some time, and we really don't know how he's going to do when he has to face the electorate again. And his competition has a much more recent and proven track record, and that applies to all of the potential opponents across the political spectrum, whether it's Kasich or Christie or Cruz or Rubio or Rand Paul or Rick Perry. They all have had more recent forays in the electoral arena, and I would trust their skills to win an election more than I would trust Jeb Bush, who hasn't faced an electorate for 14 years. And I see East Bay Larry in the chat. Want to welcome him. I want to also check my switchboard and see if anybody needs attention. Okay, nobody needs attention. So I will continue. So the first purpose of an election is to win it. And obviously, I have reservations about whether the Bush, Jeb Bush, can fill the bill about the most basic task in an election, which is to bring home the bacon and actually win the office. We do not want to go have another repetition of these narrowly engineered victories that G.W. Bush won in 2000 and 2004. We need a game-changing election, and I just don't think the Bush tradition is really very good at bringing that off. The next problem that I see with the Bushes is in the realm of coalition building. The Bushes tend to be destructive when they're in a leadership role that has to hold the Republican coalition together. And oftentimes, they provide a lot of ammunition to their political enemies and adversaries who use it to damage the Republican Party and the Republican brand. And this goes back a long time, too. George H.W. Bush campaigned against the voodoo economics of Ronald Reagan, and that label stuck, and it did enormous damage to Reagan's effectiveness in getting his program through. Now, he did get his program through, but the whole voodoo economic term and concept was used as a stick to beat the Reagan people over the head with for many years during and after the Reagan administration. When George W. Bush ran against John McCain in 2000, that was a very bitter and destructive election in terms of primary election in terms of its impact on the Republican coalition, and the legendary nastiness of the South Carolina campaign, where some of the evangelicals who were supporting George Bush really did some pretty reprehensible things against the McCain campaign. Those memories lingered for many years and caused a lot of resentment. George W. Bush was overly solicitous, in my view, of the social conservative wing of the Republican Party to the extent of really disrespecting and ignoring the other key wings of the Republican Party, the Libertarians, and the fiscal conservatives. And George Bush, on his domestic policy, was very addicted to big government. And one of the things that really drove that home to me was the extent to which he got involved in the Terry Schiavo case in Florida. That just showed the ascendancy of the social conservative influence in what really was a matter, whatever you thought of Terri Schiavo or her husband or the life ethics involved in the case, that really should not have become a federal case. And it did. And the fact that it did, I think, illustrated the primacy of the social conservatives in the George W. Bush administration. Now, with Jeb is not liked by a lot of the key constituencies in the Republican Party, and I am wondering if we're going to have a repeat of the nastiness of the Bush-McCain fight, especially given the skill that the Bushes have of using surrogates to wage their battles. I'm concerned that he'll do the same thing to derail up-and-coming politicians like Marco Rubio, and that will be very divisive. And then finally, just the general wrap-up of this theme, it's clear on a number of issues that Jeb Bush is out of touch with the conservative base. The conservative base is very concerned about immigration. It is very concerned about Common Core. It is very concerned about limiting the power of the federal government. And Jeb Bush, on a number of occasions, has proven himself very comfortable with a big government agenda. And I think that is going to be very destructive to the cohesiveness of our coalition if he were to become the leader of that coalition. So I've got a lot of reservations about Jeb Bush on that score. Okay, and then East Bay Larry makes a remark about Walker firing echo bureaucrats on Earth Day. I have to say, I mean, that was a nice touch. We're actually going to get to an elaboration of that theme in a little bit. The next thing I want to go into is the subject of advisors. The Bush team has a very established circle of advisors that have been with them a long time, and they value loyalty as their primary virtue. And that is not a promising environment for innovation and dialogue. And those advisors are pulled from the establishment wing of the Republican Party. And the establishment wing tends to crave tranquility as among the highest of the virtues and tends to cave to the left at strategically bad points. And when they can win a victory, they don't pursue it, and then they often lose it. And that, of course, is something, as East Bay Larry points out, that politicians like, Walker, they are not afraid of contention, and they are not afraid of battles. But the Bush mentality shies away from confrontation. But I think we have to have somebody who is more comfortable with confrontation, and they have to be advised by people that are more comfortable with the battles that take place in politics, because this is not 2000 anymore. The country really has moved very much to the left, and to get it back, we can't rely on consensus politics and politics as usual. We have to be willing to fight battles, and the leader of our party has to have advisors that are willing to fight battles, and that is not something that would come to mind as the identifiable characteristic of the Bush team of advisors. So I think that since so much of the direction of a presidency is determined by his appointees, I think that's something we really have to consider. Do we want a lot of Bushies back in key advisory and policy rate making roles in the federal government, and I just don't think so. Okay. Moving on here. The next thing on my list is skill at managing identity politics. Whether we like it or not, identity politics are a reality of the current political scene. And of course, Hillary Clinton is going to wage a battle of identity, the mother of identity politics, because she's going to try to be the first woman president. And there is a very clever phrase that Camille Paglia uses that whenever Hillary wants something or gets in trouble or runs into opposition, she turns on the estrogen light and takes advantage of her status as a woman. And so to have somebody go up against her and win, we need somebody who is skilled at identity politics or can offset it with something else. Now, one way you can offset identity politics is to campaign on the basis of new and vigorous ideas, or you can campaign on generational change, point to yourself as the representative of a new and upcoming generation that the future belongs to, and or you can kind of play the identity politics game yourself by pointing to something unique about yourself that responds to ethnic loyalties. And we have a lot of candidates in the Republican Party who can do that. Obviously, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz have Hispanic backgrounds, so they can play that part of the identity politic game. They also have, Ted Cruz, of course, has very vigorous and very different conservative ideas, as does Rand Paul. So, and all of them, Rubio, Cruz, and Paul, can play a generational card. So you can't beat something with nothing, and we have to have in this world of identity politics, we have to have a politician who can either compete on those terms or offer something as a substitute. And like I said, ideas, youth, generational issues, or identity, ethnic identity itself can all be a factor. But I don't see Bush offering any of that. He's been around forever. He's very closely identified with the Bush brand and his brother and his father. I just don't see him offering anything new to counter the gender card that Hillary is going to play and play shamelessly. And Jeb Bush's policy stances are going to alienate the existing base, because he's very fond of doing cram downs for his favorite policy issues, especially open borders and Common Core. And with open borders, I think even though he may favor open borders, Jeb Bush does not have the oomph to have crossover appeal with Latino voters. So he's not going to get an advantage that way, but he's going to alienate existing support within the Republican base. So it's kind of the worst of both worlds. Okay, checking switchboard. No one has called in. And checking radar. I want to see the tornado before it gets here. You know, I just I'm kind of anal that way. I want to have at least a little warning if there is one on the way, but there is actually a thunderstorm, a pretty significant one, to the north of here, but it doesn't look like it's anything more than a severe thunderstorm, and it doesn't look like it's heading in this direction. So let's hope for the best. Okay. All right. So I think just going on my list here, foreign policy. Foreign policy is not something that ordinarily would come up in a discussion like this, but I think it is a real problem with when you're talking about a Bush candidacy. I mean, Republicans are usually pretty united when it comes to foreign policy. All wings of the party are basically in agreement with the need for a strong defense, the need to counter terrorism and to protect the country against it. Rand Paul is a little out there in terms of some of his foreign policy notions, and he has understandable libertarian concerns with some of the things that the government has done as counterterrorism strategy. But the Republicans are pretty united when it comes to foreign policy. However, we're talking about a Bush. And when you are contemplating putting a Bush in charge of foreign policy, all of a sudden, a lot of reservations stop popping up in the minds of the voters. The voters are very wary of the Bush tradition of interventionism and nation building and military action. And I think that there has been a consensus that George W. Bush was simply not as good at foreign policy as his father, that the team of George H.W. Bush and Jim Baker understood the limits of military power better than George W. Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld. Jeb Bush has even less direct military experience than George W. Bush. I think the public is very concerned that the military has really taken a beating, that it is stressed by downsizing and wasteful and ineffective wars. It's depleted and it must be rebuilt before any renewal of interventionism can take place. The big mistake of the Bush-Cheney administration, in my view, was that they were not sufficiently cognizant of the impact of the 1990s downsizing on the nation's military, and they overextended the military in response to the events of September 11th and the Iraq War and all of the rest of it. Now, it's very understandable why they did what they did, but the fact was that there was a mismatch of means and ends, and the military bore the brunt of it. I think we have to go back to the notion that the military is a public trust and a public asset, not to be depleted and squandered on ideological or even humanitarian whims, and that the foreign policy establishment, which has very little understanding of what it's like to be in the military or how the military works or the sacrifices that the military makes, that the foreign policy establishment has to be reined in when it comes to the risk of overextension. And with $19 trillion of debt, the United States has to begin to recognize the limits of its own ability financially as well as militarily to keep intervening in different parts of the world. And finally, the big problem with the Bushes and foreign policies goes back to this establishment craving for tranquility. Wars are a very exhausting undertaking, and when George W. Bush took us to war in the last decade, they were unwilling to take on the leftist opposition, which was determined as the Iraq War ran into trouble. The left used every opportunity that it could to undermine the war effort and to defame and undermine the military, and that's where so many of the themes, anti-military themes that arose on the left, were never countered by George W. Bush and his team of advisors. That the whole notion of, that our military are torturers and they're abusive and they ran amok murdering people and this, that, and the other thing, these themes caught on like wildfire on the left, and they were never effectively countered. And while the American people always backed the military, there is no doubt in my mind that the resolve of the American public in seeing the Iraq and Afghanistan wars to a successful conclusion was undermined, and that made the calamitous decisions of the Obama administration possible. And I don't want to put the military back under the control of a team that is going to use it but not defend it in the public square effectively against the inevitable shenanigans and antics of the left. And that's why I have a big reservation about putting another Bush in the Oval Office. And I don't think the foreign policy establishment has really learned anything from our, the often tragic history of our involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq, because under Obama, they did pretty much the same thing. In adventurism after another, not as significant as Iraq, but in terms of the mess that was left behind, very much on a par with Iraq. When you look at the impact of our policy in Libya, in Egypt, in Syria, the status of forces agreement in Iraq, and the withdrawal of Iraq, and the rise of ISIS, and now the Iranian expansion, its attempts to get a nuclear weapon, its adventurism in Syria and now in Yemen. I don't think our foreign policy establishment is still inclined to overextend itself, to not match means and ends, and to get ourselves into just a lot of trouble. And I want to play, and they often do it for the best of motives, which are humanitarian impulses. So I'm going to play this one clip from David Starkey, a British historian, who made a very good point. He's discussing the British role in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he's pointing to the central reality of the risk of getting overextended and why it is such a risk. So I'm going to play this, and then we'll take a little break, and then we'll wrap up the other themes. It looks like tonight is not an active call-in night, so I should be done talking in a few minutes. But here's the David Starkey clip.
Sometimes.
What happened to my production difficulty here? My mic got unplugged. Let me plug it in. Okay. All right. Someday. Computer is fighting me. All right. Okay, here's David Starkey talking about the limits of foreign policy overextension, especially for humanitarian reasons.
Right, and we intervene in Kosovo, though, without approval, because we recognize that sometimes we have to. So I guess the question is, how many people need to die? How many people do they need to kill before we're going to do something about it?
David Starkey. Kosovo was a disaster. Kosovo and the Balkans are now a series of United Nations protectorates. They are ungovernable and unsustainable as states. Humanitarian intervention is almost always disastrous. Let me give you an example. It's called France. You will remember Britain and America liberated France. What thanks did we get from it? The French have spent the last 40 years trying to obliterate the shame by doing everything they can to damage Britain and America.
Well, no D-Day, no invasion, we should left it to the Russians.
I'm just saying, what I'm trying to do is to illustrate that people don't like being free. They mistake liberators for conquerors, which is exactly what's happened in Afghanistan, which is exactly what's happened in Iraq, which is, you know, a testament of shame to Britain and America, of utter disgrace. And it would be exactly what would happen in Syria. You go in, you become the enemy. Only one person can make you free. It is yourself. Only a country can free itself. The French freed themselves in their revolution. We didn't have humanitarian intervention to save Louis XVI.
Are you saying there should have been no Allied invasion of
France?
No,
I'm not.
To remove the Germans.
We didn't go into France to liberate France. We went into France to destroy Nazi Germany. What I'm trying to do is, David, you will occasionally detach your mind from your prompt sheet and listen to what people are saying. What I was saying was, people do not like being liberated. The French had to invent a myth of their own liberation. And it's exactly the same in Afghanistan. It's exactly the same in Iraq. It is, thank God, we did it lightly enough in Libya. But we had this weird notion, exemplified above all by the, you know, divinely ordained Tony Blair, that you go and give people...
All right,
freedom.
I think we have the point. Thank you very much.
Like
the man in the third row there.
Okay. Well, I think David Starkey overstates the case a little bit, but it is a case that needs to be pondered and analyzed and taken into account whenever foreign intervention is on the table. I would rationalize and soften that a little bit to say that you cannot go in and intervene in a country where you have a vacuum, that it is one thing to support for humanitarian reasons a force that you think is preferable for humanitarian reasons, but you can't go in and counter a dictator and have nothing domestic in that country to fight against him with. You cannot do nation building out of nothing. And I think that was the painful lesson that we, you know, learned in Iraq. Now, that Stark eclipse was from a debate in 2012 when Libya, it wasn't clear at the time in early 2012 when that was recorded what a mess Libya was going to turn into. It was considered a successful intervention. And, of course, later in 2012, the issue came up about intervening in Syria. And, of course, Obama was on the point of intervening. And then the British House of Commons voted down a resolution that would have authorized British involvement, military involvement in Syria. And once that happened, Obama changed course, and as tragic as the outcome in Syria has been, I don't really see that there was any alternative. But anyway, the point is basically the risk of overextension and getting involved where you're trying to create an opposition to something that where there is no ready-made opposition, and even with the best of humanitarian motives, I just don't think that's a workable strategy. But it is something that the foreign policy establishment is tempted to get into time and time again. Okay. So now we're about ready to wrap up here, and I just want to check studio and chat. Chat is light, and there's no one on the phone that wants to talk. So let's wrap it up with a general discussion about the Bush brand. Again, like I said at the beginning of the broadcast, the Bush political dynasty is very established. It has a commendable record of public service. I believe they're patriots. I believe they want what is best for the country. But the brand is damaged. And even though a Jeb Bush would likely be a competent executive, it's not enough anymore. The brand is damaged, and it will be very hard to get the public to change the perception of the Bush brand in this current generation. It may be up to the next generation of Bushes to change the brand. The Bushes tend to be electorally ineffective. They are not politically astute. They are not good at keeping coalitions together. They are not good at the rough and tumble of politics. And alas, they are more skilled at pissing off parts of their base than they are at winning over opponents. They tend to dismiss and diss the base, especially the conservative parts of it. They have a very poor track record of being able to communicate, of displaying energy and arguing and persuading and shaping and changing public opinion. There is a lingering distrust of the Bush brand because of the events in Afghanistan and Iraq and their oversight of the foreign policy of the country and the overhang of the George W. Bush legacy. There is the overhang of the performance of the economy under both previous Bush presidencies. If you recall that one of the reasons why George H.W. Bush lost the 1992 election, we were in a recession, and he didn't seem to be very engaged with the economic problems being faced by ordinary Americans. And, of course, we all know about the huge meltdown that occurred at the end of George W. Bush's presidency. The general, and I guess on coalitions, something it just I wanted to bring up, it's hard to imagine this right now, but when George H.W. Bush got elected in 1988, he carried California and New Jersey, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but he might have carried Connecticut or come very close to it. Those things would be unthinkable now, and I think that that is a testament to the tendency of the Republican base to shrink under Bush leadership. And since the overriding objective of nominating a candidate is to win the presidency and to make a difference, I think that the track record of the Bushes at this point in time is such that you have to doubt their ability to do either one of them, that they will be very challenged in winning, and if they do win, they will be very challenged in creating and formulating an effective conservative alternative that changes course for the country. We need something and someone new who can motivate, inspire, and expand our base and take us to victory. And I just don't think Jeb Bush and the Bush legacy at this point is capable of doing the job. So with that note, I'm going to close the broadcast. I want to thank East Bay Larry for dropping into the chat. For people who are going to listen in archive, I will put the show on the Minority Report with a summary description, and you can access it there. I've also tweeted it. You can get the show link there as well. So I'm going to close with a little ditty that I think summarizes the dilemma of the Republicans, because we have a lot of good candidates. We have a lot of people who have very different ideas about our party and what direction it should go to. So it's all kind of like walking on broken glass at the beginning of a campaign, when all of these divisions come bubbling to the surface. But they have to come. We will get the right candidate. And in my view, that candidate is not Jeb Bush. Thank you all for listening, and have a great evening. Night.